You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Svante Myrick.
Hey,
Svante, yeah. It's good to have you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So the way we begin the show is with the huge question, who are you? What do we need to know about the life you aspire to live, your labels? I mean, we know you because you're the mayor of Ithaca, but what do we need to know for this conversation?
Oh, gosh. That's a very good question, and it's a funny one because it seems to be always evolving. You know, for most of my life, I was Leslie Myrick's third son, you know, and Shalita Myrick's older brother, and I was the short one, and I was the less athletic one. I was the bookworm,
right?
And I guess I'm still all of those things. I'm still the short one. I'm less athletic, and I'm the bookworm. I'm still Leslie's son too, and I'm a I'm the grandson of Red and Phil Ravel, you know, who were both teachers in my school district. And Red, in particular, was famous as the local band director in a village of 800 people. That makes you, you know,
he's
like our Frank Sinatra. He's
right. You've got the drum beat of the community.
That's right. That's pretty good. I might put that on my next bumper sticker. And it's funny because, you know, something happens when you run for office is everybody assumes you're a politician. You know, if they thought that you were well-spoken before, then they think you're just being slick now. Or if they thought you were smart before, maybe you're just polished now. And they assume, but it's funny, something really does change. You know, being mayor is, of course, my title, but it's the kind of job that's so all-encompassing, it becomes part of who I am. It would be one of the first things I told somebody that I met.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, the first 2 months in office, it seems like you're wearing somebody else's clothes, right?
Right. 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 You're getting a lot of looks and expectations that you haven't had to wear before.
That's right. That's exactly right. And it just feels like, I still remember the first phone call I had to make in office and calling and saying, hi, my name is Svante Myrick, and I'm the mayor of Ithaca, you know, like that.
And you're mumbling right
exactly,
now.
Exactly, right, exactly. Yeah. I'm the mayor, and I wanted to, and they're like, what was that? I'm like, I'm the guy that was elected the mayor. But something, you know, they say you truly know a language when you start to dream in it.
Oh.
And I am to the point now when I wake up at 4 in the morning, it's the first identity that's in my mind is that of the mayor. And, mm-hmm. and so that's, but you know, I guess that's me. That's who I am.
Right, right, right. And I want to come back to some of the experiences that have helped mm-hmm. you fill out that role, but also to see yourself that and more.
Yeah.
What should we start with musically?
Why don't we just go right down the list? Let's start at the top. It's one of my all-time favorite songs. Maybe my all-time favorite song.
Aha.
With should I intro? You sure? It's Eric Sermon and Marvin Gaye. This is a song that my best friend and I defined the summer. You know, when you're 13, is maybe the most important summer of your life. And this was it for me. The song was all about it.
Just like music. So I can be free and absorb the sound that keep me round, doing my thing constantly with no worries, peace to keep Murray. Just like music. To keep me flowing, to keep me going, to keep me growing, to keep me to eat from knowing what happens out there is not my concern. You want to die, it's not my turn. Just like music. To do something to me like jumping the Mercedes on the highway, doing over 80 without music, baby.
I'll go crazy. Just like music.
Make me call my homie on the phone like there's something new out that got me in the zone. Just that feeling got me. I wish music can adopt me.
Just like music.
My
woman. Got me in the air, singing sweet nothings. Make love come out the mouth, no fronting, like all of a sudden.
Just like music.
Taking away your worries and cares. Any problems, music will be right there. Together match, yo, we a perfect pair. Is that true, Marvin?
Yeah, music.
Yo, to get you the bangness, body soul snatcher, universal language, it be the light. So open up, this is it, what the fuck?
Just like music.
One fly tune to have black and white vibe in one room. No confrontation, poly or night, it's just a sensation.
Just like music.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Svante Myrick. So Svante, you talk about becoming the mayor, but it's also for you, it's becoming kind of fully fledged adult, it's becoming all sorts of stuff, but you wake up as the mayor. When did you know that you had that agency, that you had that sense of purpose and role?
Good question. And in part, and you know, it's funny, I think I became mayor actually before I became a fully fledged adult. In fact, I know that I did because I'm still evolving. I was alarmed.
Well, we all evolve, but those in the 20s, those are major.
Yeah, big years. Well, I read just a couple of years, I was 26 and I read this a science article that said that our brains haven't fully formed until we're 25.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I took office at 24. What was
that? Yes.
You know, it's funny. It's an evolving thing. I'm not sure there was any one moment when I decided.
Well, when did you realize that whatever that space is, I'm now here. I've arrived.
Right.
How did you realize it?
Mm.
I mean, you noted the story of the dreams, but I imagine that you felt it at other times.
Yeah, there are pivotal moments. There are moments along the way, like when I was a child and we never had a lot of money and my mom would ask us to help her budget, right? Like we would sit down together and she wrote out all on the left hand, all the money that she had, that she got in that paycheck, and the right hand, all their expenses. And we'd start making choices together. That's a lot of agency for a 10-year-old to have. Yep. And I remember being 16 years old and my high school mentor, my guidance counselor, Mr. Sherry, was supposed to moderate a school board debate. He had to go out of town. So he called me. He didn't call another teacher. He called me. Right. And he said, "Do you want to moderate this debate?"
Right.
And it was the first time I ever held a microphone, you know?
Wow.
And I got to ask, and I was like, "Will you give me a list of questions?" He goes, "No, you should write the list of questions because you have to ask them." And I took it way too seriously. You know, these are like local parents who just wanted to, you know, make sure that the lunches were okay. And I was like, in the 2002 No Child Left Behind Act passed by George W. Bush increased, you know, and they're staring at me like, what's wrong with you? But in each of those moments, I crossed these thresholds from feeling like someone ought to do something about this to realizing that I was a someone.
Right.
who ought to do something about it. And I remember for mayor, there were a few moments like that, but the one that comes to mind, people locally may remember, although maybe they don't. It's very funny. The things that construction projects, especially,
yeah,
people are very have, yeah, short memories. They say the most fleeting emotion in politics is gratitude. And but sometimes it's good because you may remember Clinton Street was closed, but the bridge was closed while we rebuilt it and repaved Clinton Street and added sidewalks and that nice retaining wall. This was 2012, so it was my first year in office. It was a project that started under my predecessor. And I remember that the staff kept telling, you know, I told them, I said, okay, no matter what you do, just don't do me a favor. Don't start this construction project a week before graduation. Right?
Right.
And don't end it 1 week after, or a week before graduate, and don't end it 1 week after the students come back from school, right? Like, try, do everything you can to avoid at least one of those major markers if you can. So sure enough, a week before graduation, they tell me we've got to close the road. And I said, okay, well, if that's what you have to do, we have to close the road. And I was over there at the police department. The road was closed for 4 days, and the entire Ithaca College community was furious with me. The whole community is questioning, this is very silly. Right, you've got 15,000 strangers who are coming in. Their GPS is going to be telling them to take this route. They're going to run into a dead end. So I'm at the bridge is blocked off. I come out of a meeting at the police department, and I watch a pizza delivery car go around the barriers and go up the hill. And so I called our superintendent of public works, and I said, I thought you said we had to close it. I thought it was going to collapse. He goes, oh, no, it's not going to collapse. It was just, you know, it's easier to close it. I was like, all right, well, then open it. And he said, if that's what you want, we can open it. And I said, well, okay, then open it. And then it was opened. And you know, it's a small moment, but it was a moment where I realized that the reason I'm in this job is to ask those questions and to insist on those things.
Right.
And to not assume that someone else ought to make sure that everything is working functionally, you know,
right.
to remember that I am that someone who ought to.
Right. Well, yes. And the ought for you is you ought to see what's happening here from the point of view of everybody who is here.
Right.
And a person whose job is infrastructure maintenance is to see it from the point of view of infrastructure.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily work out the same.
It's so funny that you say it that way, that I've always felt that our engineers, and we're lucky in Ithaca especially to have some very humanitarian engineers, uh-huh. or rather some humane engineers. But most engineers, you ask them, why does a bridge exist? To exist. You say, no, a bridge exists so that people on one side
can get to the other.
Yes. Yeah. And they'll go, no, oh, because in their ideal world, they'd build a bridge and then nobody would be allowed to step on it because then the bridge will stay pristine and it'll last for as long.
Monument to technology.
That's right. Because a ship in harbor is safe, but
right. That's
not what ships were made for.
One of the things that I noticed, there was a polling researcher who died this past fall, and he was the guy who coined the term, now I'm going to block on the term, reinventing government. And that was the clarion call of the Clinton Gore campaign and a book of that same title. Anyway, he found in the late 1990s that Americans had felt like their voices no longer mattered, that they could not affect the political outcomes of the United States. And this was a significant founding because it basically meant that what's the sense of agency, being actually able to impact by your actions, had left long ago, but even losing your voice was something that he had picked up on in the polling.
Yeah.
So you have a sense of agency, and if we were a real functioning community, everyone would have a sense of agency.
That's right.
But how, you know...
How do we foster that? Yeah, I think it's tough. I think, to me, part of that has been focusing on the right populations, right? So there are populations that have always felt agency. They still do. They feel like they're in control. They know that their votes matter. They vote every election. Mm-hmm. They call up their elected officials. They write them letters. They do feel like they're in control.
And it's not necessarily a squeaky wheel, but the person in touch with you is the person who gets attention.
That's exactly right. So part of my feeling is that the first thing we have to do is use different channels. Like actual different communication channels, right? People who write hard copy letters to their city council members will always get good service. But the person who had never written a letter to anyone in their life, but does tweet or is on Facebook,
right?
Right? Or, or is home when you go and knock on their door. They've never had that kind of interaction and engagement. So it's not just me doing it, but getting our entire government to reach out to people on different channels than the ones we're used to is a big part of building that agency.
Right.
I think responsiveness too. You know, it's the kind of, anybody could write a letter, but if nothing happens after you write the letter, you don't feel like it mattered. Part of what we created in my last term was this report a problem. I call it report a pothole because that's most of what gets reported.
Right.
But it's a tool on our website where you can report any problem that you see, a street light down, a pothole, a skunk in the road, any problem that you see at all. Mm-hmm. And it gets tracked through our internal system. So you get an email when somebody has read your notice. Mm-hmm. You also get an email when somebody has added it to the work list. You get an email when the item has been completed. So that kind of real-time feedback helps people know that going out of their way to take the time to reach out about a problem, not only is that time not wasted, but it makes them feel powerful.
When you sat down with your mom and the budget mm-hmm. and the kids, and I mean, I started working to help support my family when I was 11.
Wow.
Technically, that was illegal. Yeah. And technically, they paid me. I was working at a grocery store.
Okay. That's what I did when I was 14. I worked at a grocery store.
And then I worked on farms and painted houses and did all sorts of stuff. Wow. But in any event, when you have that kind of responsibility, you're always kind of looking to the past, to the present, and the future, mm-hmm. and everybody that you're impacting.
Right.
So you're already carrying yourself, as you said mm-hmm. before, with more agency. How did that come to college? Mm-hmm. How did that sense of purpose survive the transition to college?
It's a good question. It almost didn't. I have to confess that my first semester here was a kind of a dark time. It was like mm-hmm. a lost time. I came from a small village, and there were 800 people in my town. So when I told, I remember it was Bobby Napolitano's mother, I told her, it's 800 people, and she goes, there's 1,000 people live on my block in Brooklyn. And I was like, wow. And Cornell felt like it. It can be a dark time. It can be very, you know, foreboding. People don't look at you, don't smile at you, don't recognize you. So what pulled me out of it truly was coming downtown. A friend of mine in November of my freshman year, she convinced me to come and start tutoring kids down at Boyan Middle School. Ended up tutoring every semester all throughout college. And that connection to the people like Eloise Barrett, who the families that made me feel at home, pulled me back to that same sense of agency and purpose.
Okay. Yeah. I assume you were probably in large courses and didn't have the study skills.
Exactly. If I showed up at all, right, to class, it was the first time that the teacher not only didn't recognize you, but wouldn't notice if you weren't there. And I was like, oh my gosh, if they don't notice, I'm not. I mean, in Irville, you can't get away with anything, right? The cop doesn't just know your name. They went to school with
your family history.
Exactly, right. Right.
So yeah, I came from a similar sized rural area in the Midwest and had a wonderful first semester, but I took a 6-credit course and 2 3-credit courses, and none of them had more than 15 people in them. So that you had to be there.
Right.
And that gave me such a tremendous sense of confidence.
Oh, that's really good.
And it was really good. But then when I had to make the transition, it was dark.
Oh, yeah,
and it
yeah.
was very hard to right. find anything to hold on to.
Right.
You know, how did you migrate into wanting to become involved in politics mm-hmm. and to stay here?
Yeah, it was another good question. It was another migration, you know. It was sort of one step at a time. My interest in service, you know, working with the kids, I cared about a lot. So they asked me to start running the program. And that's a bit of a different, that's a leap to go from mm-hmm. direct service to program. But I really liked it. And I liked, you know, arguing for more funds for my program. And I got pretty good at it. So this other service agency poached me, which ended up being Cornell Cooperative Extension. And there at Cooperative Extension, they had a program called Reality Check that was run by a young man who was on the city council. He wasn't that much older than me. He was already on the city council. And I started going to meetings with him and helping him do his work. And so that was another step and then another step. And then he left. And this was maybe the largest step, which mm-hmm. is, you know, I'm 20 and I'm a junior. And it's a 4-year term that's available. And to go out there and actually put your name out there and to go and knock on people's doors mm-hmm. and ask for their votes, that was the biggest change. And then during council, realizing just, you know, I was still doing social service work after I graduated. Mm-hmm. I was working with young people at the Learning Web to go, to realize that the parts of my day that I was most energized were the parts I got to go into City Hall. And after, you know, a city council meeting, Mayor Peterson would go back upstairs to her office and I'd shuffle out of the building because it was time for me to go, mm-hmm. you know. So, and I knew that just serving the entire city like that was what I wanted to do. So I don't know. I guess I still haven't decided. People are like, how'd you decide on a career in politics? I'm like, I'm not sure that I have yet decided on a career in politics.
No, just it's each one step election is, to the next.
Right. Yeah, that's right. But it's been good so far. So
what have you had to learn about yourself that you didn't want to learn about yourself to fill this role of mayor and to be an adult? I mean, what have you had to learn that you would not necessarily have chosen to learn?
No, that's interesting. There's a real eagerness to please other people and to make them happy and to keep them happy mm-hmm. that I find in myself both unattractive and mm-hmm. often counterproductive. And it's a funny.
It's genuine, it's the gold standard. But when right. it's not, when it's abused or not genuine, it's
that's right
poison.
Right, and those are two very right. Those are there's a blurry line between wanting to make someone happy and wanting to make someone like you.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
No, I know exactly what you mean.
Yep. Wanting to make someone like you is poisonous.
Yeah.
But and wanting to make someone happy isn't necessarily poisonous. Wanting to make everyone happy leads to, it's impossible. But reaching for it will lead to like duplicitousness. And because there are real conflicts in city government, right? Somebody wants a bike lane. And another person wants their car parked there. Right. So this isn't, you know, it's not like quantum physics where both things can exist at once, right? You strive for compromise where you can get it. Right. But either a bike lane or a parking spot is going to be there. So if your desire to be liked by everyone and to please everyone leads you to, during a campaign, promise the bike advocates that you will build a bike lane, but then promise the people who own parking spaces that they can still park there. Well, you end up like Donald Trump being like, I'll be a fighter for the working class. And then you're in office and the working class is like, where's all this fight?
You know? But how do you hold conflict and not, I mean, because that's what you're saying in the bottom line. How do you hold conflict and how do you look at the other people so that you can say we are in conflict and you're in conflict with each other and I'm not going to solve that. Right. What changes inside of yourself? What's the nature
I don't know.
Of that relationship?
I don't, you know, to serve as, I mean, this is an interesting question because ideally my job would be to decide whether it's a bike lane or a parking space, mm-hmm. but also to make everyone involved in that decision feel okay about, not about the outcome, but about the process, right? And you can do that by recognizing their humanity, by listening proactively, by giving good feedback. But there are also folks who are, their dissatisfaction and their unhappiness has nothing to do with me, the bike lane, or the parking space.
Right.
They have an anger or frustration that is real and lives, you can see it when you talk to them, it lives behind their eyes, it lives in their heart, and it's because of something that happened earlier that day or that year or when they were 5 years old. Right.
Yeah.
It's hard for me, this is something I've learned about myself, to just let that lie, to not try and heal that as well or try and make them feel better. But, you know, it also, the real constraints in the job, that's not my job. You know, my job is to build the bike lane and hope to let everybody feel okay about the process and move on to the next challenge.
Right. And you're not using a word that I want to introduce here.
Yeah.
And that word is suffering. As with change comes loss and gain, and we suffer both of them. Even if we look forward to the gain, we suffer what we lost that we liked.
Right.
And even if we don't, and especially when we don't like the gain, we suffer more, perhaps bitterly. But I don't hear any politicians talking about how we can suffer this time together.
But it's
when you talk about holding people in these conflictual spaces, this is how we suffer.
Right. Yeah. I think the reason we don't hear politicians talk about it often is that it's not what we want out of our, you get punished for it. You know, what's true is that we reward it often posthumously. Politicians who talked about suffering and sacrifice, the JFKs and the Abraham Lincolns, the ones who said, you know, that we should ask not what our country can do for us. And the ones who said that, you know, we praise those who gave the last true measure of devotion and who talk about the real pain required to move from where we are to a more perfect union. Those are also the politicians that most bitterly, bitterly divided the country in the moment, right? I mean, Abraham Lincoln, it was by definition the most divided time. And I think even Barack Obama, who, as sensitive as he was often quick to recognize the suffering that would come from a policy. And what happened? We swung so far the other way. Barack Obama would always say, we're going to improve healthcare, but you should be aware this will take a lot of, it'll be complicated, and we're going to talk about it for months, and we're going to, and then where did the country swung? We swung to a guy that said, oh, fix healthcare day one. It'll be so simple. It'll be cheaper and you'll get better care.
Right.
We'll fix taxes. Everybody will pay less taxes, but also the deficit will go down and the economy will soar, right? And he won, and most elections work out like that, where, you know, whoever promises the most, we've seen it in our middle school elections, whoever promises that we'll have pizza every day and you'll put soda in the water fountains, that kid gets elected class president.
I guess, even in high school, I used to help manage other people's campaigns in high school. Nice. That was my role.
Yeah,
nice. I ran for office when I came to Cornell as an undergrad the first week on campus.
Is that true?
Yeah. And
which
and,
office? The student assembly?
Actually, there was no student assembly. There was a university senate that had control of all of the budget except for the academic side.
Really?
And it was a significant role. It was one of the things that Frank Rhodes required that the trustees kill before he came and took office in 77. So I lost my role. I was on the academic policy committee because that whole entity was ended. And that was part of what sent me into kind of a sense of lack of agency, because I had won in a pool of five candidates with 49% of the vote. So I was, as you can see, there's a certain amount of pride in that.
Yeah.
Coming from a hayseed from Missouri, I couldn't talk English straight. And then it was gone.
Yeah.
And I didn't really... I was too adrift. But getting back to this, we had, you remember in 68, there were the African-Americans put their fists up in black power sign in Mexico City, and then they were stripped
Olympics,
of their...
Yeah.
Well, we used that in all of the campaigns that I did in student council. We were conflict-oriented.
Huh.
We were not afraid, and we knew it was going to be a process of suffering.
Right.
And these were conservatives, but they weren't reactionaries at that point. There was a rural area that had a progressive element. So we knew conflict. We had farmers who would dump milk or slaughter animals to try to raise the price, and we had others that felt that was morally completely reprehensible to waste food in that way. But my sense is that we have a higher tolerance for conflict as a country, especially now, but the politicians haven't stepped into that space.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is there anybody in the national scene that you see
doing
that?
Not that I'm seeing now, and maybe it's my blindness, and that's part of why I'm asking.
Yeah, I think it is easier. I see a lot of folks doing what you're describing at the local level, but only because it's harder to lie.
You can't deny it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You can't lie about the nature of this stuff. I mean, It is easier for me to lie to you and say, if I'm going to lower your income taxes and we'll cut the deficit and the economy will take off, because it's abstract, right?
And it's going the consequences out to 300 will be some million people who,
right. Yeah. And the consequences we won't fully know until 6 years from now.
And many administrations later.
Right. Yeah. Tomorrow that will either be a bike lane or a parking space.
Right.
And so, getting away with papering over the real, trade-offs. the real conflicts and the real suffering that comes from change isn't possible at the local level. I don't think.
Right.
It's not possible for long anyway.
Right. Let's cut to music and we'll come back. So what should we play next?
We could just keep going. I got to tell you, I appreciate you letting me play music. This is super fun. This is what I bother my friends at home. I'm like, ooh, listen to the song I like. And this next one is The Roots, who just came and played in Ithaca and did an incredible show. And I finally got to meet Questlove, who's been my drumming hero for a long time. This song in particular, called You Got Me, there's a riff in it that comes about 2.5 minutes in that it almost broke my spirit. I could not figure out, and I got to tell him that. This is a song that's like 20 years old now. I got to tell him that, and he laughed so hard, and he said it took him 8 months in London listening to this one particular street drummer to figure out how to do this beat. So that was a weight off my shoulders to know that I wasn't just an idiot, that he that even he struggled with it.
So, and you're a drummer, and I did not know that.
Yes, in high school, yep.
There we go.
We used to live in the same building on the same floor and never met before until I'm overseas on tour. And peep this Ethiopian queen from Philly taking classes abroad. She's studying film and photo flash focus record. Says she working on a flick and cut my click through the score. She says she loved my show in Paris at Elise Momar and that I stepped off the stage and took a piece of her heart. We knew from the start that things fall apart, intent to shatter. She like, that shit don't matter when I get home. Get at her through letter phone, whatever, let's link. Let's get together. You think not? Think the thought went home and forgot. Time passed. We back in Philly. Now she up in my spot. Telling me the things I'm telling her is making her hot. Started building with her constantly round the clock. Now she in my world like hip hop and keep telling
yeah.
Sometimes I got to be out at the height of the night, and that's when she flipping get on some
old. Another lonely night, it seemed like I'm on the side. You only loving your mic. I know you got to get that paper, daddy. Keep that shit tight. But yo, I need some sort of love in my life. You dig me? While politicking with my sister from New York City, she said she know this ball player and he think I'm pretty. Side, I'm playing, boo. You know it's just what you want, staying, boo. And when cats be bopping game, I don't hear what they saying, boo. When you out there in the world, I'm still your girl. With all my classes, I don't have the time for life's thrills. So when you sweating on stage, think of me when you rhyme. And don't be listening to your homies, they be
yeah, so what you saying, I can trust you.
Is you crazy? You my king for real. But sometimes relationships get ill. No doubt.
Celebrity, I deal with the real. So if it's artificial, let it be. I seen people caught in love like whirlwinds. Listening to these squads and listening to girlfriends. That's exactly the point where the whole world ends. Lies come in, that's where the drama begins. She like, yeah.
I've been a who I saw.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Svante Myrick. So, Svante, as you continue to live in this role, mm-hmm. what are the kinds of things you're learning both about yourself and about politics and about this community? So what is the stage being set for you moving forward? What are you mulling? What are the changes you see coming in the future that you're going to need to adjust to?
For me, the city, or
all politics? Of the above.
All of the above.
I mean, basically, but the question starts with you,
right?
And what are you responding to, and mm-hmm. how are the changes being called out of you from what you're seeing in the city or in mm-hmm. politics? So that you continue to grow, and that you continue to mature, and that you remain effective.
Yeah, I think it. That's changed most starkly. I mean, I'm 10 years into my service now.
Yeah,
I'm 6 years into being mayor, but the largest change I've seen happened a year ago when Donald Trump became president.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it was a change in. I mean, it required both tactical and strategic changes in how we run the city, right? Because we went from a city that was the most urban friendly in history, likely, to a administration that is openly hostile to cities, period. Mm-hmm. Like, they're doing everything in their power to hurt cities and the people that live inside them. But more than that, it's changed the way people engage with what they want from, what they need from their governments. Mm-hmm. I think it was a big wake-up call for a lot of us who assumed that progress was assured, that things would get better, and that, you know...
progress would happen on our terms.
Yes, right. And on our time frame, right?
Never...
Yeah. What I'm finding is a far more emotional engagement with politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always been true that people want to know what you care about. You know, as they say, nobody cares about how much you know until they know how much you care. Right. That's always been true, but it's even more true now because there's a deep concern, I think, that the people at the very top of our government don't care about us. And if that's true, it's alarming. It can make you feel alone, and it can make you feel scared. So more than ever before, people in the city are asking of me, demanding of all of us who work in government, to prove to them, you know, every time we propose a solution to a problem, they want to know first, why do you care? Do you actually? And I need you to prove it to me. So I think that's been a real big change in the last year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think the demand that people care in the last year on the more to the center left is similar to the Tea Party movement and a demand that people demand that their elected people represent them or care for them in ways that represent that are more white conservative and whatever, to not overly racialize it.
Well, I think there was a big racial aspect to that, right? They looked at Barack Obama and thought, this guy can't possibly care about me, not because of anything that he'd done in his life and not because of anything that he said, but just because he looked different. Here we have a different, and so I think that was a racist reaction. They thought, gosh, this guy in charge doesn't care about me, a real American. He cares about Muslims and he cares about blacks and he's not going to take care of me, even though everything in his background said that he actually cared about everybody. You look at Donald Trump, his own words and actions shows that he doesn't think that women are people, that he doesn't think that people of color are equal to white folks.
Right.
And I think, you know, that's more than me just looking at him thinking, oh, he's a white guy, so he doesn't care about anybody. It's by his own actions.
And I think there was something. I mean, I'm definitely going to agree with you with Donald Trump. Yeah. I'm not going to agree with you on Barack Obama. I was a student of Cornell West, and Cornell is not very forgiving of Barack Obama.
It's because he didn't get tickets to the inauguration.
No, I think the problem was long before that.
Not really. No, he loved him in the campaign, and then he didn't get tickets in the inauguration, and suddenly he was mad.
Not from what I remember hearing along the way. The problem for me was that I had an opportunity to interview Barack Obama and Michelle Obama in 1995 in Chicago when I was doing my dissertation research.
Nice.
But I was studying how people create and control wealth in some of the poorest and most violent neighborhoods in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I said, so what has he done to create and control wealth?
Mm.
And they said, well, he's organized voters. Yeah. I said, but what does he do? How did he do that in a way that's explicit to create and control wealth so that these people kind of have a better toehold on their destiny?
Yeah.
And they couldn't say anything. And they spoke about him in utterly worshipful terms.
Sure.
Him and Michelle, they're going places. This is 1995.
Yeah.
Nothing has happened yet. Yeah. And I said, he's outside what I'm trying to study.
Mm.
And because he hasn't. And it was tempting. And on some levels, I wish I had. But he didn't understand the creation and control of wealth, even though he came into one of the worst economic times that we ever had.
Right.
And he was not comfortable. He was visibly uncomfortable in a visceral way in many settings, including poor settings of color.
Hmm.
And that's and that that to me and let and not to mention white settings, which was any time. That shows me that you're not representing me, even though you desperately want to. You have maybe all the right policies according to my thing. But if you look uncomfortable among the people, it's gone because that's a visceral reaction.
Yeah. I guess I will have to agree to disagree because I saw something very different in the man.
Yeah. But what I'm seeing now is that all politics at this particular point is visceral. And because of where I came from, I have a sense they were reacting to somebody who had no clue and didn't show interest in having a clue about where they were coming from. And I kind of sit in the middle on this stuff because I live in multiple worlds, as most of us do, as you do. One of the things that people, I believe, where Trump made headway was that he basically got people to support him who feel so alienated that it didn't matter who got elected. They want somebody to throw a wrench in the system.
Yeah.
They have never benefited materially from the system. That's their belief. And they weren't going to benefit by whoever got elected, but he's at least a good show.
Yeah.
You know, my relatives and people from the Ozarks just used to laugh at how how awkward they could make us feel by how badly they could behave by social convention. And that's exactly what he does.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he also, I don't think we should give the folks who voted for him too much credit for playing out some sort of socioeconomic power play where they put revenge on. I think we should never forget that the more charismatic, smoother talking, taller candidate almost always wins. The one who promises the most almost always wins. And here we had a guy who was world famous and had been beamed directly into people's households as a pretending to be a successful executive businessman. And that still existed in a lot of people's minds.
Yep.
And then he was unashamedly willing to promise, like, so Hillary Clinton would have the same answer no matter what you asked her about, you know, our factory closed. What are you going to do? And he goes, well, we'll change the tax code to build an economy that works for everybody. All right, well, the corner store closed. What are we going to do? We'll change the tax code to build an economy that works for everybody.
Yeah.
He would arrive in town and he'd say, I heard that that paper plant closed down. Elect me, I'll open it again.
Yeah.
So he was willing to just lie and make promises he couldn't keep.
Right.
That's a pretty good way to win votes.
Right, but it's also he was willing to respond to the emotional demand of the moment, even if it wasn't viable.
Yes,
and,
right.
And the thing is Hillary didn't.
That's right.
And this gets back to what you were talking about before. We've become we've come into some more emotional times.
Yeah.
And Ithaca in particular is a pretty heady place.
Yeah.
And intellectualizes everything.
Mm-hmm.
But our politics are becoming more like if it needs to be intellectually accurate,
right,
emotionally honest, and visceral, compelling to the senses. It needs to be viscerally engaged.
Right.
And if it doesn't carry all three, we probably ought not trust it.
Right.
And we had two candidates, neither of which we could trust, because neither of them could communicate with that level of integrated truthfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm hoping is that we can see a kind of a busting out of people trying to relate across many of these venues, because when you see that kind of integration, you appeal across traditional divisions of race or class or education levels. You know, it's just...
I hope so. I don't know.
Yeah.
I hope so. I don't know that that's, I mean, I don't know if that's true, right?
Right.
I don't, because intellectual honesty often gets punished, particularly in large elections, right? When you have 360 million people to
intellectual
say,
to accuracy, up, emotional accuracy, honesty,
right.
And compelling to the senses,
right.
Moves people to act, yeah. Make no small plans because they fail to move the hearts of men and women.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's what I'm tossing out there. So,
yeah. I like the sound of it.
How will you seek, I mean, you by being mayor of Ithaca, you are in effect in a demographic bubble.
Yeah.
But if you ever go beyond this boundary, mm-hmm. There's relating to people that are going to be much more like the town you come from,
mm-hmm.
As well as other places that are many measures in between.
Yeah.
How do you see yourself growing as a person to be mm-hmm. able to directly speak to them and emotionally acknowledge, if not share, their pain with empathy.
How can I relate to the people I grew up with?
Or the people who are outside of this bubble, not necessarily the people you grew up with. Right. Or how does your being in the world change? Mm. How do you look and act in ways that reflect that environment when you're there? And how is that different from here?
You
may not perceive a difference, or you may not want to perceive a difference, but how does...
Yeah,
is there,
I don't think it changed. I mean, look, I think you're a product of, I believe that surely people can change, but I do think you're a product of where you come from.
Yeah.
And I think I'll always be the boy from Earlville, so I'm as comfortable in a fire hall in Groton as I am, you know, in City Hall in Ithaca. And I don't think that'll ever change. I have a harder time relating to wealthy folks.
Yeah, no, you know, I can
or
imagine.
Worldly
I mean,
people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How I do that, I'm not sure. I mean, if I were to stretch in that way is, it's tough, but there are universal human experiences, right? I mean, that you can always.
I'm gonna push, yeah, yes. Yeah. But what I'm gonna do is we tend to want to go to the universal.
Yeah.
I don't think that is helpful in these days.
Yeah.
Because where we want to impose commonality, mm-hmm. that's kind of like feels like co-optation.
Okay.
And to people who are not sure they like each other and not sure they want to go forward together,
right.
Co-optation is generally the first thing that they bristle at.
Yeah.
So we need, I think, to figure out how to cut into that.
Okay.
What has worked for me is you should not, as I should not be ashamed of my poverty, mm-hmm. you should not be ashamed of your wealth. Mm-hmm. The issue is, what are we going to do?
Okay.
Or how are we going to go move forward together?
Okay.
So that we all get what we need.
That was Hillary's campaign slogan.
Which one?
Stronger together.
Stronger together, so that we all move forward together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that she modeled strength together, because mm-hmm. the discomfort level in presentation and ability to interact. I know mm-hmm. it's, you know, it doesn't deal with the intellectual superiority, but it mm-hmm. it deals with the human relationship mm-hmm. thing. And how do you work through your relationship with people who are more affluent? That, to me, the only way is to not hold them. I mean, I went through a really radical left-wing phase at a time. It doesn't help
right.
for me to judge myself superior to them or for them to judge themselves superior to me. Mm. There's a lot of work to be done.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. I think, too, I think you mentioned we all live in different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us were raised in different worlds. Like we all have different identities, right?
Right.
You're your brother's sister. You're also your mother's son. And
right.
those are,
right.
there's a lot of overlap between those two people, but it's not perfect.
Right.
You know, it's not perfect overlap. I think especially for those of us who are third culture kids, you know, people who don't share the same culture with our peers or our parents.
Right.
That is even more pronounced. And we're used to living in a world where we're, have to find a way to relate to everybody, right? So my mother wasn't mixed, my father wasn't mixed, and most of my peers were not mixed, mm-hmm. right? So none of them were growing up or had the exact same experience that I did, and that that forces some
it forces you to reach,
right?
and it doesn't, and they can, they might be able to assume that they don't have to reach. And we're in a moment in history where people, we're not sure whether people are going to reach. You've already been through the ringer, right, so to speak, on that.
Right.
I want to change gears, but this is actually going to build on this. What do you do to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, intellectually, throughout the day, daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis? And how do you know you need to do that kind of self-care? What shows you that you need to do it?
Well, for me, it's irritability. That's how I know when I'm exhausted or hungry or dehydrated, is if I am irritable. You know, I won't know that I'm tired, or maybe I just won't admit to myself that I'm tired otherwise, until I'm like, why did that meeting annoy me so much? You know, why did I get grumpy on that phone call? So, you know, for me, taking care of myself actually means, and I'm fairly extroverted, but my job is entirely extroverted, right? It's entirely external, and I never have a moment where it's like, okay, I've got 3 hours today where I'll be by myself and I have to write something.
Except maybe when you're asleep.
That's really, truly, I mean, truly, that's it. And so recharging for me, both emotionally and spiritually and physically, is all now about being alone. So, and I used to love basketball. Part of that's my schedule, so it's too hard to
you can't commit to a game.
Right. And you need other people to play basketball.
Right.
And that means planning ahead, and it's just no good. So riding my bike, the elliptical in the winter, which I hate, but I do anyway. And reading, getting alone time with a book is my, those are my favorite moments.
When did you become aware that your self-care is your responsibility? And I'm not talking about taking care of your mom and your siblings and stuff as part of a family with a sense of agency, but one level back from that.
Pretty late. I mean, I'm still not great at it.
Most people aren't.
Yeah. Yeah.
It takes a long time.
Yeah. There are certain moments that it'll sort of hit you in the face. I remember in college I pulled two all-nighters in a row, and I was going to run this program. It was an outdoor movie night for kids in Trumansburg. And I was just exhausted, and I packed the car up, and I drove all the way out there, and I set everything up, and I had a projector, and I had the screen, and I didn't bring my laptop from which I was going to play the movie.
Right.
So all these families are playing in the park, and I had to drive, you know, from Trumansburg and get back. It was 45. I get back 45 minutes after the movie was supposed to start, and half the families had gone home.
Right.
And it was a real, bummer to let people down because I wasn't taking care of myself, or even, you know, things that you know you should be doing. I remember too, in college, I was having the worst stomach aches. I mean, real bad stomach, and I was like, oh gosh, I'm dying, so this is what stomach cancer is like. And I go to the health services, and she just goes, how many times a week are you eating pizza? And I was like, none of your business. And she goes, how many how many beers are you drinking a night? Why are you asking me these questions? How many cups of tea are you drinking a day, and how many hours and I was like, I'm here because I have stomach cancer. Why are you asking me all these unrelated questions? And she's like, I want you, for the next week, you know, drink less, eat better, drink less caffeine, sleep more, and come back in a week. And sure enough, it cured my stomach cancer. I was pretty sure it was gone. So things that, you know, you'd think by 19 would be obvious, sometimes life has to kind of put in your face.
Right, right. I mean, that's 19, you're lucky for some people. And some people learn it by age 9, and some people don't learn it until age 49 or 59 or 69.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's not necessarily easy taking other people's advice and bringing it in and holding on to it.
Right. And it's very obvious if it's somebody else, right?
Right.
Like, I mean, this is a kid. I never got a single question wrong on a health test ever in my life. It's like, should you eat pizza every day? False. Should you eat vegetables? It's a true. So it's easy, but it's harder to see in your own life.
Right. you had said you're not a particularly athletic person, but mm-hmm. you do ride your bike, you do mm-hmm. the elliptical, you try to get outside when you can.
Yeah. And I walk everywhere. I should say, you'd have to see my siblings to understand. They're
athletes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have two brothers who played college football, and I
didn't. Oh, really? So, yeah. So you get it.
I get it. In a profound sense, I'm circling back just a little bit. Mm. We began with this notion that you grew into a sense of agency, and that this we would be better as a community if people had more of a sense of agency, and not control,
right,
but ability to participate and impact.
That's right.
And my take in what's happened in this country is that we have fundamentally different understandings of how agency works. Hmm. Among liberals, it tends to be that you need to be part of an organization or a system, and the rules and the locus of control is within the agreed upon rules and processes and strategies and established facts. Hmm. There are many people, particularly poor people, and particularly people who are rural, who for whom a sense of agency is, you need to know how to fix everything that breaks down in your life.
Hmm.
And you need to be able to hold each other accountable individually.
Hmm.
And for a lot of these people, whether they're persons of color or not, there's a sense that they really, that's their domain.
Hmm.
And a lot of what happens in liberal agency doesn't respect the individual agency in the other narrative.
Hmm.
And we haven't figured out how we can do both, because we have to do both.
Yeah.
We need institutions and structures. I didn't mean to turn this into a sermon,
but
that is how it looks to me, because I'm familiar with hillbillies and white trash, and people called me that.
Yeah.
And they called my neighbors that.
Yeah.
And that's just, it doesn't sit well with me, because I know how competent they are,
right,
and how hard their lives were, and how much they've done to make it different.
Sure.
With or without success.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true.
So this is a conversation for another day.
Okay.
And maybe we'll clip it out. Yeah. What should we close the show with today?
Is a topic or is a song?
A song.
Well, why don't we?
And you can topic too, if you want to close it with some comments.
Well, let's. I think it's one of the happier songs on the list. We could do the Francis and the Lights.
Sure.
I also think it's happy because I swear, if you can listen to a song and not hear Phil Collins, I'll give you $5. It sounds to me just like a Phil Collins song, but I also love this. I've come to love this artist and the song, and just want to say I appreciate this opportunity. I don't often get a chance to talk. You know, most often when people have questions, it's like, when will my pothole be filled on Third Street, or what? You know, what height should the a building? What's the natural height for a building? You know,
right. Or what is your position on some issue?
Right. So I appreciate this chance to talk and think and hear from you and listen, and I hope we get a chance to do it again.
Yes. That would be good. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Good to see you. And here we go.
In the ground we bury the seeds of a pantry, all the things we can. May I have